Okay, I think that we can begin now with the next three speakers. Yes, please, run it. We need a little darker for the slide. Well, we're just coming from two very, very intense panels this morning and this afternoon, long overdue. Now we'll go into a lighter side, very pleasant, and I don't think anybody could do better job than Tom Owen to bring that. It's almost a strange thing because I have known Tom Owen for many years through our common association with the Audio Engineering Society, and I remember Tom in Los Angeles, we were talking about equalization curves and recording all 78s and so on. But I never suspected the other side of Tom going into, yeah, he has another side. Right. One side, he's a very, very well-known recording engineer. He has his own company, Old Products. He has done many, many technical writings on 78s, dubbing. He works for the Royce and Hammerstein. He had done some wonderful job there. But 2 years ago, I got the surprise of my life when I got an offer from him to do a program on the Beach Boys. And I just couldn't believe it. And I was so eager to hear his presentation. I came to California in 1961, and ever since I have been very much into the surfing scene. I love surfing. I write a monthly column until now on the Surf Report. It's a publication about surfing conditions in Malibu. I live there, I go to the beach. So when I heard that Tom Owen was gonna present something about the Beach Boy, I was so eager. And of course, it was terribly disappointing in Toronto when he had to cancel because of illness. He was in the hospital. So we had to wait for one more year. So now, I'm so curious, I'm so eager to hear a very, very light, entertaining, instructional talk about his association with the Beach Boys. So here, Tom Owen.
My association with the Beach Boys is a personal one. As a musician, I traveled around as an opening act in instances in Indiana and Kentucky and sometimes Tennessee, opening up for the Beach Boys and lots of other acts. And our job was to back up whoever the opening artist was. We did a little bit of a show and then we'd come on with the Shangri-Las or somebody like that. So it was a good experience and I got to know them personally. And that's good and bad. They're a very unusual group. I met Brian Wilson in 1963 for what I hope would have been many, many years association, but he, in 64 and 65, Brian Wilson is the lead, is the leader of the Beach Boys and the one who did all of the writing and all of the arranging of their songs. And in my estimation, he's probably one of the very few rock and roll American geniuses around, mainly because his writing is so structured harmonically in terms of the music. The music itself, I'm going to play some band tracks from the Beach Boys, and you'll see that the music is very simple and very basic. As soon as you add a vocal to it, it becomes altogether something else. I'm going to play just a little edited tape that I made with several of their hit records from about 1962 to 67, and you can just remind yourself what you were doing when you heard these songs on the radio.
Get around, I get around,
yeah,
get around, round, round,
I get around, fine, 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 till your daddy takes a T-riddle.
Do you love me? Do you surfer girls?
Wendy, what went wrong, oh, so wrong?
Ah.
picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations.
God only knows what I'd be without you. In my room.
All the engineers out there checking my edits, of course, right?
Good segue.
Good segue. That those songs cover a period of their great, what I consider their greatest output, from about 62 to 67 or so. And I have some slides here of the early Beach Boys. You got to remember, the Beach Boys are a family. There's three brothers and a cousin that are involved in this. Let me just throw up a slide and show Dad and Mom first, all right? Whoops, we got to turn it on. This is Murray Wilson. Now, Murray Wilson is exactly how he's pictured here. He was their father, and he was the one who was instrumental in beginning their career and keeping it going. He was a little somewhat headstrong, so I'm told. He drove around in the car, pressed their own records. Like, if any of you have been in a band, you know this whole routine where you make a song and you press it up and you go from station to station and try to get them to play it, and you do local concerts, sometimes even for free. And Murray would organize this thing initially, and he started going around to the record companies early in about 61 trying to peddle Surf and Safari, which had been recorded a little bit earlier. He eventually got somebody by the name of Morgan to put it out on a local label. This is one of the first pictures of the Beach Boys in 1962. I think this was shot at Capitol Records. And these are the people. This is Mike Love. He's a cousin. This is Dennis Wilson. That's David Marks, who was only in the band for 1 year, from 62 to 63. That's Carl, and that's Brian. Brian Wilson is the arranger and producer of all their records. This is the Beach Boys, which most of us are familiar with. Al Jardine was originally with the group in 61, in early 62, and he left for a year and then came back. And this was the group that recorded, and even today is still recording most of their songs. Now they have a member by the name of Bruce Johnson, who's been with them since 65. This is how I first met the Beach Boys. They had all these type of shirts. They were playing in my hometown of Louisville, Kentucky. I believe it was 1963. And it was the last time I was ever to see Brian in concert, because he quit touring in 64. Now, this was a problem for them, because the way the band worked was he was the mainstay. He was it. He did all the arrangements. If he didn't like the way one of them sang on one of their songs, he'd go back to the track and sing it himself. He could sing all the parts, both low and high. Mike Love was considered the lead singer, and he would do the ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, all that stuff that you hear on the Beach Boy records. And he had a tendency to sing flat. You don't notice him much on the records, because Brian would always go in and overdub his part. So. Bring it up a pitch. This is my attempt at becoming a Beach Boy in 1965. That's me right there. Now, this is just an aside on musicianship in 1965. We carried the entire band and all the equipment for this concert, which held 18,000 people, in this van. Now, you can imagine how today, if you go to concerts and you see 50 speakers lined up all around the stage, this is what they did. They took the stuff right out of Fender Twin Reverbs, and Brian used to play bass out of a Super Reverb amplifier. That's another shot of me. Now this is backstage, I believe, in Indianapolis. All the times we were doing this, I never had the foresight to hire a professional photographer except once. And these are the shots that we got. This is Bruce Johnson, who replaced Brian in 65. Now between 64 and 65, Glenn Campbell sang Brian's parts on tour. You remember Glenn Campbell, right? This is Al Jardine, Carl, Mike Love, and Dennis Wilson. Now, I want to stop here for a second and show a little bit of the musicianship and the arranging that Brian did on their songs. We have, let's see, two songs to listen to. God Only Knows. God Only Knows is one, which you're going to hear the band track, and then you're going to hear the same section with the vocals. Pretty simple band arrangement. There's nothing, especially compared to today, where you have all the synthesizers and everything happening, the fill-ins going on. All the fill-in was done vocally. The whole premise of the Beach Boys sound is a vocal sound, is a harmony vocal sound. Pay close attention to the bass line that Mike Love is singing on this.
If you should ever leave me, life is too good, believe me. The world could show nothing to me. So what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you.
If you notice on the lead, on Brian's lead vocal, he's modulating in very short increments as he's singing from one line to the next. That was very unusual for that time, musically very unusual for that time. You don't hear any of that in the band arrangement at all. There's no instruments following him or doing it in such a way where you would normally do that sort of thing in a modulation. The next thing is we're going to listen to Wouldn't It Be Nice, which is a song that they put out shortly after that. And it's the same thing. You're listening for the vocalization that's going on. The band track will be first, with the singing.
Thank you.
Now, if you listen, you hear this shuffle beat, the shuffle sound. That dun da dun da dun da dun da dun da dun. It was the backbone of many of their hit records. Musically, it was not done with the shuffle like, but it was done on with the drummer and the hi-hat doing two different things, with the drum boom on one and then somebody else doing the hi-hat. When they made these records, the musicians that they used most of the time during this period were the Beach Boys. It was later on where they started using Hal Blaine on the drums and all sorts of hot LA studio musicians. But initially, Dennis, who was the drummer, was the drummer on many of these sessions. Although Brian, as indicated later in life in interviews, he many times went back and wiped the tracks and started all over again and hired somebody else. This is what it sounds like with the singing. Now, I should comment that somewhere around 1964, there was an English group that came in called the Beatles, and it hurt American rock and roll bands on the radio in a big way. Not just the Beatles, but the English invasion, where you had the Beatles and the Stones and all the various groups that were later to become so big. Many radio stations programmed English music almost exclusively, you know, very much to the detriment of the Beach Boys and other American bands that were popular at the time. This really bothered Brian Wilson. He had, according to interviews and so forth, he was very upset that he could not create the perfect record, which he was always trying to do. And because of that, the Beach Boys have one of the greatest unreleased catalogs of American rock and roll bands. They haven't thrown everything out at us that they recorded during their best years, and they still have it. What happened to Brian was, unfortunately, when he quit touring, he had some time on his hands, and he started dabbling in psychedelics, to put it nicely. And he ended up being a recluse in his house in California for some 3 or 4 years, at which time he created very little music. One of the stories that's told, which I know to be a fact, is that he had him bring tons of sand and dump it in his living room so he could sit with his feet in the sand while he was attempting to compose and take drugs and some other things that are not conducive to good songwriting. This went on for some time, and fortunately, in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, he started coming out of this and sought some help and was able to, again, produce some music, although in my estimation, it's never been the same as it was prior to that. But the Beach Boys are really Brian Wilson. And although I don't know if he's put out an album by himself recently. There's a new album out with just him with, with some new music. Personally, I don't think it comes even close to the old stuff. This is, again, some other shots. This is Bruce Johnson. He has been producing the Beach Boys since about 74, 75. Many of the records, the newer records that you've seen from the Beach Boys, were produced by Mr. Johnson. I don't know if any of you remember Bruce and Terry. Bruce and Terry were on Columbia Records, and they, Yeah, Terry Melcher. Now, I'll just mention this because Dennis Wilson died in a drowning accident in 1983. Terry Melcher and Dennis Wilson were friends, and Dennis Wilson had befriended Charles Manson. And Charles Manson and all those, the consortium of people, had lived in Dennis Wilson's house for some a nine-month period. And Dennis, I remember that was a real problem, obviously. He couldn't get him out of the house, basically. And they ripped him off for about $500,000 worth of stuff and so forth. And finally, they had to get the sheriffs and all those people to throw him out. This was before all the murders and that Manson was put in jail. Manson wanted to become a rock and roll star and wanted Terry Melcher to produce him. And that was one of the reasons why they went to that house looking for Terry Melcher, where those people were killed. Now, this is a good statement on Dennis Wilson, okay? We were at a concert in, I forget where this was, but somebody had brought along that pie stuff that you spray out of a can, and he went around, he made it a point to go around and hit at least four or five people, myself included, at this concert. And Dennis was a real prankster, and he used to have a good time playing practical jokes on people. That's the DJ who hired him, so he had no shame. I want to play one last song, what I think is the ultimate Beach Boys song. Thank you very much.
For a few questions. So if you have any questions, could you please go there to the microphone? And if you want to give your name.
Christine Hoffman from Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Yes, I know you.
I haven't seen you for almost 24 hours. It seems to me that the Beach Boys were recording in that period between the time when the performer controlled the recording, because basically the performer stood up in front of a microphone and laid down his or her art, and the time later on when the sound engineer controlled the recording. In other words, the tracks were laid down so infinitesimally separately that the music was really produced by the engineer, not by the musician, if you know what I'm talking
right.
about. And it seems to me that the Beach Boys were sort of right in the middle of that, and I'm wondering exactly where on that timeline their recorded legacy lies. And I guess the real question in that is, when one heard the Beach Boys live, would they have sounded the same as they did to someone like me who listened to in my room.
Well, the first part of the question is the Beach Boys recorded their early stuff on three-track recorders. Okay, most of the time, Brian and Mike Love were on one track. Then they put the rhythm section and the overdubs on another track, on the other tracks. All these early, not all of these early hits, but many of these early hits were done on three tracks. That's why it's when CDs came out, they could do is someone would just double the tracks. In other words, take the three tracks, bump them over to 24, digital delay them, and so to beef up the sound. And then, but one thing they didn't do, they didn't add instrumentation on some of the new re-releases on CD, which is something to be said for, because many of the rock groups have. They've redone the bass lines and so forth. In answer to your second question, no, they don't sound the same in person live that they did on records. The only time I ever heard the Beach Boys sound like the Beach Boys was in 1963 when Brian Wilson sang with them. Other than that, they have gone from pretty good to almost horrible, unlistenable. And that's unfortunate. They played in New York City in the 70s and drew 200 people because their music had just gotten, I guess the public felt that they just outgrown the Beach Boys.
But was it the function of that, or was it because Brian Wilson wasn't singing all the parts?
I think it was the Carl and Dennis, they needed Brian around. The band needed Brian around. When the band didn't have Brian around, they were in deep you-know-what. And it was if you travel with these guys, I mean, they were the original party animals. They knew how to have a good time, I must say. And so they didn't take their business very seriously, whereas Brian was quiet and shy and didn't go out crazy, get crazy and that sort of thing. And he would rehearse them before the show and all that. After he was gone, none of that happened that I was ever aware of.
Jack Saul, Cleveland, Ohio. This question is from my son. We waited a whole year to get an answer. He's a collector of the Beach Boys, and he found a Capitol album. I'm sorry, now I don't remember the title of it, but it had the usual titles on the first side. Second side was the usual Capitol label, but nothing on it, no contents. Is this the way it was issued, or was there, do you think this was a misprint or what?
Paul might be able to answer that. I'm not a record collector as such, and I really don't know what the reason. I know they issued a lot of stuff in Europe with the same covers as American, but the songs were different. And in some cases, there were some label and misidentifications, and there were songs that were listed that were not there, and other songs were there. But I can't really answer your question. I don't really know the answer to it.
Okay.
But Steve Ram might know that. Do you know that?
I don't have any like that. It's just a normal issue, so it may have just been a misprint or
not printed at all.
I've got all the original issues, just having gone and bought them at the store. Something like that. Paul maybe would know.
Paul Mawinney from Record Rama Sound Archives. That's just a misprint. I don't know of the existence of a regular commercial release like that. One thing I would like to say, I happen to be honored enough to see the Beach Boys in 1964 at the Lois Penn Theater in Pittsburgh. It was the shock of my life to see Brian Wilson and the crew with sound recordings in their live performances, the first band that I've ever seen use sound recordings in their presentation.
They did use sound recordings?
Yes, they did. I was shocked.
I had seen them and worked with them probably a dozen times, and they never did that as long as I was around.
Well, they did on this tour.
That was at the end. You know, that was when he was, losing
They had rows and rows of equipment and tape decks and all kind of things. What was coming out of their mouths wasn't what was on the machines.
Well, if you've seen the Beach Boys in the last 3 or 4 years, they're carrying background singers, full instrumentation, some really good players and so forth. But Brian can't, in my opinion, Brian vocally has lost it. And it'll never be the same as far as I'm concerned.
Steve Ram from Philadelphia. You mentioned earlier that they've got one of the largest unreleased groupings of recordings. And outside of the Smile album that I think everybody would like to see if he ever gets around to remixing it, which Brian says he's going to do, who owns all the rights to these? Are these Capitol items, or do they have them? Or,
well, Brian had a production contract with Capitol and later ones, okay? It was the smartest thing he ever did. He owns the publishing and he owns the production. So he has the most stable income of the entire group, which allowed him to drop out. That's why one of the reasons he dropped out. And as far as the production, now this is also in litigation, so, but right now, Brian has the masters. And as far as I know, he can do whatever he wants to with them.
How much unreleased stuff is out there?
200 titles, so as far as I know.
I'd like to hear your comments on some of the more musical aspects of the group. When I listen to the Beach Boys, I hear everything from the influence of barbershop quartet singing on up through the doo-wop groups, the girl groups, Phil Spector and Frankie Valli. And so far you've been discussing the Beach Boys and Brian Wilson as a discrete musical entity, and I'd like to hear you put them in some kind of context.
Well, Brian was a Four Freshmen freak, okay? Now, some of you may remember the Four Freshmen.
I try not to, but it happens.
But they think highly of you. No, they were a tremendous vocal group with harmony, and sort of like triad harmony. And it wasn't absolutely perfect harmony. There were people would be singing octave on one another in the Beach Boy records and in their live performances, and you can hear it. You can hear it in their records. I think Brian's contribution was he was able to paint, so to speak, a vocal mosaic, and he learned a little bit from Mozart and other people, and he knew how to run the bottom end against the top end and make it all work out. And I think, although I don't know if he ever thought about that at the time, although he did listen to classical music, he was able to just come up with these ideas and bring them to fruition. And he could sing all the parts, which he many times did, and that's why they were so successful. As soon as he fell out of place, so to speak, they went right down right from that point. Thank you very much.